From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Democrats and the lessons of a losing campaign. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point. If John Ossoff had won yesterday in the Atlanta suburbs, his campaign would have provided a blueprint for other Democrats to challenge the GOP. But he lost after the most expensive congressional race in history. So was his typically centrist campaign a blueprint for failure? It's the fourth special election defeat for Democrats with an unpopular Republican in the White House. Many anti-Trump activists around the country are angry. They're tired of waiting for the national party to do something right, and they're organizing on their own at the state and local levels. Later on today's Talking Point, will the U.S. Supreme Court finally rule on partisan gerrymandering? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Oren Olney, back with To the Point. Since their candidate lost a congressional race in Georgia last night, Democratic Party regulars are licking their wounds. But around the country, some party activists aren't just disappointed. They're planning to start something new. We'll hear much more. On today's Talking Point later, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that electoral maps that dilute the influence of minorities are unconstitutional. It's tolerated maps drawn to favor Democrats or Republicans. Now it's accepted a case that could change American politics forever. First, this news update. Uber may have changed transportation practices all over the world, but it's lost almost $3 billion last year. Yesterday, after hours of reported drama, Uber's founder, Travis Kalanick, was forced by investors to resign as the company's CEO. Allison Griswold reports for the online business publication Quartz. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the investors gave Kalanick a letter called Moving Uber Forward, but it wasn't just all about losing money.
No, so Uber has sort of been besieged by scandal for the last 6 months since this year began. It started when one of their former engineers, Susan Fowler, wrote a blog post about experiencing sexual harassment during her year at the company, and it just spiraled from there.
Is Kalanick himself involved in these scandals?
Well, you know, there's the saying that culture starts at the top, and investors often choose to back a company because they're on board with the founder. And Uber is really a great example of that. People say Travis fashioned the company in his own image, and that's a cliche, but with Uber, it's also true.
He's 40 years old. Obviously, that's young for somebody who's made billions of dollars. And I take it he's still going to be on the board. He's resigning as CEO. But that means he still has a lot of power as well. Doesn't he own a lot of the company?
He does. He has a significant stake in the company. And it came out a week or so ago that some of the shares held by employees were also structured such that when they chose to leave the company, their voting rights went to him. So presumably he's been consolidating power as people have left as well.
They have, in recent months, fired some 20 employees. What for? What have been the charges?
Well, so after some of these allegations came out about misconduct and sexual harassment, Uber conducted two different investigations into its workplace. And the result of the first one was that they fired about 20 people. The second one came out last week. That was from former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. And the recommendations in that included cutting ties with some other people, increasing the independence of the board, reallocating the responsibilities of Travis Kalanick. And that was the point at which he announced that he was going on leave from the company. But it wasn't until yesterday that he handed in his resignation.
Going on leave wasn't good enough for those board members, and particularly five, I take it, of the biggest investors of all. Do you know anything about the drama that reportedly took place?
Well, so what was reported by the New York Times was that the people who asked him to resign made their demand in a letter that was delivered to Travis Kalanick while he was in Chicago. And before that, you know, he, like I said, he had gone on leave, and it was sort of an open question mark what his role was going to be at the company. But I just think Uber has had so much go on this year. You can kind of weather one of the scandals, maybe two, but it's really hard to have all those things combined with the fact that your company is also burning billions of dollars every year.
What are the chances at this point that Uber will go public?
Well, it's a good question. You know, for starters, Uber doesn't have a chief financial officer right now or a chief operating officer. A ton of their top positions are empty. And the CEO famously said this metaphor about they were in middle school, they were in early high school, going public is the prom, and Uber wasn't ready to go to the prom. And I think what's clear right now is that Uber is very much not ready to go to the prom.
Uber is sort of a Silicon Valley company, if you will. Does it reflect the culture of that whole area?
It's interesting. So in a lot of senses, Uber is not an anomaly. We've certainly seen sexual harassment, misconduct, poor management. These are all classic startup problems. But with Uber, it's really resonated and caused deep changes within the company in a way that doesn't happen often.
Kalanick is thought to be responsible for the massive success of the company, even though it did lose money last year. What's it going to do without him?
Well, Uber does have a lot of smart people who are running things. It's hard to have a company of their size and global reach with only one person making the decisions. So right now, you know, they're looking to fill a lot of those top roles. They've had an ongoing search for a chief operating officer who was going to be the number two to Kalanick, but maybe now the candidates for that role will be escalated into the newly opened CEO role. I think there are just a lot of things that have to be figured out.
Okay, so when you go to your app, now you know more about what is behind it. I take it that Uber's problems have been good for competitors. We'll see how it comes out now without the man who invented it and really carried on the whole idea of the kind of transportation that Uber provides. Allison Griswold, it's great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Reporter for the online business publication, Quartz. In a moment, Democrats and the lessons of a losing campaign. On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. Georgia's rock-solid Republican 6th Congressional District in Atlanta suburbs was the target of Democrats to challenge the GOP. After President Trump appointed incumbent Tom Price to his cabinet, the race to replace him became the most expensive in history. 30-year-old Democrat John Ossoff, a political novice, surprised a lot of contributors by taking a moderate tone.
I'm John Ossoff, and I'll work with anyone to do what's right for our country and Georgia. We need to attract more high-tech and research jobs to the area. Cutting wasteful spending, it's not a partisan issue.
And we can find common ground to fix Obamacare while keeping what works. Repealing it makes no sense.
Now, the campaign for the veteran Republican, Sharon Handel, was tough as nails.
Hi, Georgia. San Francisco just wanted to say thank you.
We already have Nancy Pelosi as our congresswoman. Now you're going to give us John Ossoff as our congressman.
Pelosi and Ossoff will weaken the military. ISIS? They're overrated.
San Francisco loves them some John Ossoff.
Cameron McWhirter is based in Atlanta for the Wall Street Journal. And Cameron, it's great to have you on our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I gather there was campaign fatigue. How much money was involved, and did people, in fact, other than putting up no solicitation signs on their houses, indicate other reasons or other ways in which they were sick of this?
Well, that's actually a funny. Yesterday, I interviewed a woman who was a volunteer for Mr. Ossoff, a young woman who had come from the state of Texas. She put a pamphlet on someone's door. The man tracked her down and said, if another person comes to my door, I'm going to pull a gun on them. And that was really not, there was no one, no matter what side you were on in this race, everyone wanted it over.
Okay,
they
so
it's Bombarda, yeah.
So it's over. So how much money altogether was spent in what's become the most expensive campaign in the history of Congress?
It will have to shake out. The last numbers we were confident with was $60 million, because you have a lot of outside spending as well. That is by far the most expensive congressional representatives race in history. It also is probably the most expensive race ever in the state of Georgia, for even for statewide races. So it's completely off the map in terms of what people would spend on an election. So, and a lot of it was spent by Mr. Ossoff and his supporters, and they did everything. And I mean everything, from offering free Lyft rides to people, to Korean radio advertising, to Spotify, to you name it. Anything they did it.
Okay, there was a primary in which Ossoff got 48% against not just Handel, who only got 20%, but a lot of others as well. He was only able to get 48% against her in the runoff. During the primary, he took a tougher tone on Trump. Is that one of the major differences between what happened in the primary, do you think, and what happened yesterday?
Yeah, he could move the needle. He tried to move to the center. That was a big effort on his part to not. This is a traditionally Republican district, as you pointed out. So going to the center, to being presenting yourself as a moderate, was their strategy. And he stuck to it very, very, very closely, made sure that he never said anything disparaging about the president if he could, at any point, even though many of his supporters wanted him to. And they thought that that was going to work, and it didn't.
Has Atlanta, well, you said this is the most expensive campaign in the history of Georgia, but what about this particular suburb? And it's been a pretty lively district, it seems to me. Newt Gingrich once held it.
Yes, when he first took it, it was in a very different part of Georgia, but it is a very conservative area. The northern suburbs traditionally are a very conservative Republican area, very highly educated, upper middle class area. And the Democrats thought they really had a shot because President Trump had not done as well there as Mitt Romney had done. Marco Rubio actually had won primary in those areas. So there was real hope that among the Democrats. But I've seen this before. I've been in Georgia for a while, and I've seen this before where the Democrats get excited and then they're wildly disappointed.
Okay. Cameron McWhirter, based in Atlanta for The Wall Street Journal. Great to have you.
Great to talk to you.
Josh Krossauer is the politics editor at The National Journal. Good to have you as well.
Good to be on.
What about this takeover, if that's what happened, of the Ossoff campaign by moderates who encouraged him to move to the center? Does it appear that that was a mistake?
No, I mean, I think in a district as Republican as this district was, it was the only strategy that he really could have seriously operated on. And you know, Democratic strategists working on the race did a lot of surveys, looked at a lot of data, and they actually recognized that despite the intense anti-Trump activism that was driving his campaign, was driving his fundraising, the swing voters in that district didn't have quite as negative a view of Donald Trump, of President Trump, as the base did. And they also didn't have quite as negative a view on the Republicans' health care efforts, as you might see on think, based on polls and on cable news shows. So they tried to present Ossoff as this bipartisan, centrist, you know, the guy who sounded like a moderate Republican in his campaign ads, and they came close. But what they found is that they can get to about 48% of the vote in a Republican-friendly district, but getting those final couple percent, trying to get people who voted for Trump and then were having second thoughts about him, was exceedingly hard to do.
And the Handel campaign was pretty tough. We heard that commercial where they basically said, thanks a lot for bringing Nancy Pelosi to our area. I understand they had pictures of the Golden Gate Bridge in their television spots and in other ways tried to make that association, something Ossoff couldn't do in the other direction.
The Republicans effectively made it a referendum between Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi. And even though Pelosi is you know, doesn't have a whole lot of impact in Georgia's 6th district, her favorability ratings were very poor and the worst of any politician that pollsters on the Republican side tested. And they kept on airing these ads in different versions, connecting Ossoff to Pelosi, and that was extremely effective. It prevented any opportunity for Ossoff to get from that 47-48% to a couple more points to get to a majority.
Nancy Pelosi, of course, has been demonized ever since she was the speaker herself. Now, there was another race in South Carolina yesterday for the seat of Mick Mulvaney, who's now become the budget director for President Trump. What happened there?
So that was a race that no one really paid attention to, and actually for quite good reason. Democrats have learned that in these very conservative districts and these off-year elections, the less attention that people pay to these races, when you don't raise the attention factor, Democrats have a chance to actually have a competitive race. They actually can make things a lot more competitive than usual. So they actually came close. In fact, the margin in South Carolina 5, that district, was actually closer than the Georgia race. But I, if you talk to top Democratic strategists, they recognize that if Democrats spent money on behalf of their candidate, if they actually raised the bar, you know, Republicans would go out and attack the Democratic nominee, and it wouldn't be quite as close of a race.
So that's obviously what happened in Atlanta, and I take it happened in South Carolina as well. But there are those who are saying that if the Democrats, they only lost by 2,000 votes, if they could have come up with more assistance, maybe they would have taken it. What are they doing about recruiting candidates for next year? Are they going to look like Ossoff?
Well, look, John Ossoff became the repository of this anti-Trump resistance. But when you actually look at his biography, he would have been the youngest member elected to Congress. He's 30 years old. He worked as a junior legislative aide to a backbench Democratic congressman and only spent a couple years as an aspiring filmmaker. I mean, his resume was extremely, extremely thin. And the good news for Democrats is that if you look at their recruiting class in the House, if you look at some of the candidates that are jumping in races in similar types of districts, they're a lot more accomplished. They're people who served in the Obama administration. They're people who are physicians, attorneys, professors that have distinguished resumes. So the funny thing about this race was Ossoff, you know, he was good because he stayed on message. He sounded like a generic Democrat, a generic centrist Democrat, but he had a pretty thin resume, and frankly, he was not a particularly good candidate. And Democrats are hoping that when you actually have candidates with strong credentials that actually can prove they served in the military, they can actually sound authoritative on national security issues, that will make the difference in districts, suburban districts, swing districts like these.
Josh Krosshauer, once again, the politics editor at the National Journal. We'll come back to you in a moment. But first, let me introduce Evan Halper. He's a national reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. Good, as always, to have you with us.
Good to be here, Warren.
You've looked around the country a bit at what's happening with the Democratic Party under circumstances where this is now, these last two are the third and fourth special elections that they have lost since the election of a very unpopular president. How are they feeling about this around the country?
Well, there's a lot of tension in different factions of the party. You know, the establishment, obviously, they're not happy to have lost this Georgia race, but they feel like they have strategy and they're continuing on with that strategy. And it's a strategy that very much comes out of Washington, and it's looking at these swing districts as they traditionally have and looking at where they think they can win. But then you have the Bernie Sanders wing, the Howard Dean types who are saying, look, we need to go back to a 50 state strategy and look at some of these districts that we've been writing off, like the district in South Carolina you mentioned, and need to be competing in all these places and need to be fielding more candidates and not just having races where Democrats aren't even fielding anyone. And so there's a lot of discord in how to divide resources and also what kind of messaging should be used.
Well, they have to flip 24 seats in order to take the majority back in the lower house of Congress. Doesn't that stretch their resources a lot, the kind of 50-state strategy that you're talking about? And doesn't it make better sense from their standpoint to focus?
Right. And that's traditionally the strategy the party has used. So look, we can look at what races we should be able to win, and we'll just go with those and focus on those. And, you know, it's a very mathematical formula. But there's a lot of resistance to that, and especially after after 2016 and what happened in the election there, and it shook up the map quite a bit. And then in terms of Democrats looking at, even if they want to be precise in their targeting, there's disagreement in what they should be looking at. Should they be looking at states like Georgia, where they're rapidly diversifying, and there's always talk from local activists there that they're just on the cusp of turning blue because it's becoming so diverse so quickly. But then Democrats keep losing these type of elections where they're investing heavily, like the one on Tuesday. So, should they be going back to, states, Wisconsin, Michigan, going back after those white voters, who abandon the party and feel disaffected by it. And so there's a lot of places they can go and not necessarily a lot of agreement on where they should be going.
So, Josh Krushauer with the National Review, you lose again and again and again, even though you have a mathematically precise strategy. It doesn't seem to be doing what it's supposed to do. How does the situation compare, potentially at least, with Macron in France, who sort of came out of nowhere?
Well, look, it's different in the sense that you know, France has a parliamentary system, and it's harder to have an independent movement. It's harder to have a third party in the United States. But actually, if you look at the recruiting class, of the types of candidates Democrats are looking for in 2018, it actually is similar to the recruiting class of this centrist party in France that Macron has run on. And it's the people that don't have any political experience, the people that are not your typical Washington politicians. If you look at the list of Democratic candidates that I've already announced across the country, a very small percentage are people with state Senate, state House, county executive experience, which is usually the most traditional path in which people go from, the state legislature to the United States Congress. And that's something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but it's a big gamble that Democrats are making by betting on people with very little political experience but very compelling resumes to overcome the ideological resistance a lot of center-right voters have with the party.
And in this suburb of Atlanta, where they spent so much money trying to elect John Ossoff, the opponent, Karen Handel, although she came from out of state, whereas he was born in the district, nonetheless, she had been the Secretary of State, I think, for the entire state of Georgia. She had political experience. She was very familiar. Isn't that an argument that experience wins?
Well, it depends. I mean, we are in a very anti-establishment mood, and I'm not sure if Handel's experience actually was a political asset for her. Both in the, she won narrowly in the first round of primary, and she underwhelmed and had to face a very competitive race in this special election. But look, I mean, there are going to be different races and different districts that where different types of strategies are required. But overall, the notion going forward, not just for the midterms, but for the next presidential election, is that voters want outsiders. They want people that are outside the traditional avenues of politics. Even if Democrats hate Donald Trump, they kind of are fascinated by how he came to power, how he kind of ran as an outsider and really captured the imagination of the Republican Party voters.
But isn't the bottom line here, from your standpoint, Josh Krushauer, that the Democrats are pretty much going to stick to their pattern and not reach out? I mean, they may have political candidates with experience, but Trump had absolutely no governmental experience at all. Are they going to go that far?
Well, look, the dilemma for Democrats is that the national party, the most prominent leaders, are well to the left of where your average voter is, especially in an average House district, which tilts a little bit to the center right. So what they're trying to do essentially is try to make it less about ideology and more about professional accomplishments in the battle for the House.
Okay.
Whether that can hold, it didn't work in Georgia, it could hold in other parts of the country. We'll have to see.
Okay, Josh Krushauer, good to have you with us, the politics editor at the National Journal. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to continue this conversation. We'll have Evan Halper stay with us, and we'll talk to some others, some unhappy Democrats on our program. On our talking point later, will the U.S. Supreme Court finally rule on partisan gerrymandering? This is To the Point from Public Radio International. We're not only back with To the Point. Since the election of Donald Trump, the Democrats now have lost four congressional special elections to replace people that Trump has appointed to offices or for other reasons. Yesterday, of course, it was in South Carolina, as we just heard, and in Georgia, with the most expensive campaign in the history of Congress and in the history of Georgia. And they lost, not by many, many points, but they lost after having been absolutely certain that they, or at least talking about it, being certain that they would win. Amanda Littman is with us. She was email director for the Hillary Clinton campaign, but now she's co-founder of something very different. It's called Run for Something. Amanda Littman, good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's Run for Something, and what are you doing there?
Run for Something is a new organization we launched on Inauguration Day, committed to recruiting and supporting young progressives running for local office. We launched and expected it to be hard to get young people to want to run. We thought we'd have to hustle to find 100. In the first 5 months, we've had nearly 10,000 people sign up to run for local office.
You thought you were going to have a hard time getting 100, and you've gotten 1,000?
Yeah.
10 times 10, more than you figured?
10,000.
What kind of offices are they running for?
We're working with candidates for things like school board, city council, state legislature, all first or second time candidates who are running for a local office, your first entry point usually into public service.
This sounds a good deal like what we heard from the Tea Party not that long ago.
You know, it's a very similar idea in that you have to invest in long-term talent. You can't just throw money at whatever the most hot race is of the cycle. You've got to invest in people early in their careers. You've got to invest local and make sure that the entry point and the gateways to public office are open.
How long does it take, though, to go from there to trying to get 24 seats flipped in Congress?
Well, you know, having more people running means more people doing voter contact, more volunteers talking to people. You know, we saw in the Virginia primaries a couple weeks ago, turnout was extremely high, not just because of the governor's race, but also because there were 20 contested Democratic primaries for the House of Delegates. That meant you have more Democrats running campaigns and literally doing the work of party building and voter engagement.
So in how many states are you now operating?
So we've got candidates all across the country in nearly every state on the ballot.
Where's the money come from?
Grassroots donors, one of my favorite questions. Our average donation is only about $27, $28. We are almost entirely supported by real people giving because they think this matters.
That sounds a lot like Bernie Sanders. What about the positions these people are taking? Are they all more liberal than the traditional Democrats have been that we heard described earlier in the program?
So we take this from a place of values, not as a litmus test. We don't want to be the purity police. You know, progressive in Louisiana means something different than progressive in New York, which means something different than progressive in Iowa. That being said, we're looking for folks who are pro-choice, pro-equality, pro-working families, pro-immigrant, pro-voting rights, who believe and understand that climate change is real and something we have to tackle, and who are ready to work to reduce gun violence.
It hasn't been very long since you began this on Inauguration Day. Have there been any elections? Can you say that you've been able to chalk up any victories?
Absolutely. So we've had elections ranging from city councils in Missouri, where Susan Waterman is the new councilwoman from Washington, Missouri. She won with a total of 340 votes. We have a young woman who was running for school board outside Philadelphia who won her primary and is going to the general. We're working with candidates in Virginia, at least two of whom who worked on the in the primary and will be moving on to the general. And we've got folks all across the country who are in elections all throughout the summer and this fall, as well as in 2018.
Did the woman in Missouri win with a total of 340 votes, or did she win by 340 votes?
She won with a total of 340 votes, and as she says, she crushed it. And that's the best thing about these local races, is the number of voters that we have to reach is so small that a real person who's just willing to knock on doors can do it.
And obviously, you're not overlooking anything, clearly, if you are willing to invest in an office with that few voters going to the polls.
Well, that's the very definition of local grassroots organizing. And it's what we have to do if we want to build a bench where 5 years from now, we hopefully have members of Congress who got their start from us, 10 years members of the Senate or governors, and maybe 20 years one of the presidential candidates will have gotten their start through our recruitment process.
Would it be fair to say you're fed up with the Democratic National Committee and the way that they've been operating?
Fed up is a stretch. I think that they have really an incredible set of priorities and have to focus on certain things given their beholdenship to their incumbents and to their goals. So we are not officially affiliated with the Democratic National Committee or any of the organizations. the DCCC, the DLCC, or any of the state parties. We sort of treat them like frenemies. We want to work hard and help them and help find candidates where they don't have the time and the money to do it. And when they're not doing it, we want to hold them accountable for it.
Amanda Littman, once again, co-founder of Run for Something. Doug Peacock is with us. He's a wilderness advocate in Montana, lives just north of Yellowstone National Park, and he is somebody who has a pretty negative view of the committees in Washington. You'll remember that there was a special election there, won by Greg Gianforte, a Republican who punched the reporter and became famous for that. Doug Peacock, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you.
So you're a Democrat, and you were in favor of Rob Quist, who was the opponent of Greg Gianforte. What did the Democrats do to try to help you win that race?
Well, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee didn't do very much at all. I mean, they kicked in about $500,000 to Quist, and that was it. This was and our election was on the 25th of May, our special election, and Quist lost by about 6 points. However, he shaved 15 or 16 percentage points off Donald Trump's show in November. And there was an op-ed in the LA Times yesterday, a fine one by Rick Bass, that makes an argument for a lot of us up here. And that is, if they just could have kicked in a few hundred thousand dollars, we think we could have turned that election. It didn't happen, and we'll do it again.
Was the Republican, Greg Gianforte, a strong candidate like Handel in Atlanta?
No, he was not. He happens to be a billionaire, and that doesn't hurt him any, but there's a lot of dark money in the state of Montana, thanks to Citizens United, especially from the Koch brothers and the NRA. He got a lot of that. Towards the end, the last couple of days, he lent himself another $1 million just to fuel some really nasty, dishonest schmear ads about Rob Quist, who's a very decent man. We in Montana are sending to Congress a man, a creationist, basically, who I don't think he even believes in science, let alone climate change. And climate change, for all of us, it's a beast of our time. And I'm really concerned with that. That's why I'm not a typical activist for the Democratic Party, but I really felt I needed to really get on the stick with this one, because what's at stake here is our public lands, climate change, all of our public lands, the parks themselves, are a threat. The seat that was vacated by Secretary Zinke, and Zinke now is in the process of reevaluating all public lands like Bears Ears to see if he should eliminate it or shrink it. And that's why we're disappointed, but there's nothing wrong. I want everybody to fight these battles, every one of them, as hard as they can with equal firepower. And I don't blame anybody going into Atlanta, Georgia, and trying to win this one. We just wish they could have chosen to give a tenth of that support to the state of Montana and Rob Quist's campaign.
Should point out that Montana has only one Congress member, so it's a pretty important office.
Whole state. About 900,000 people in the single seat. Just one. Yes.
Why do you think that the party didn't contribute more to run against a candidate that you say was so weak? Was it because he had all that money, including his own as a billionaire, not to mention the Koch brothers and the NRA?
Well, we think we could have fought that off with just a little bit of funding, but apparently the National Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee decided on the basis of some poll in Georgia that, you know, the voters, the Democratic voters there were richer, they were better educated, and they didn't see any future in the state of Montana. Neither candidate, Gianforte or Rob Quist, is a professional politician. There's nothing wrong with that these days. We need a few who aren't. But I think that bothered him, too, that here's a guy that's better known as a folk singer than as a politician, and they just didn't want to take a chance. And that I do not admire that timidity. I think we have to take chances. The stakes are too high.
Do the Democrats think you're a lot of rednecks out there in Montana?
Probably, but there's some really militant rednecks from the wilderness that don't like Donald Trump very much, and we towed a few guns, too, which bothers some people. But nonetheless, there is a fierce resistance to the notions and the policies of Donald Trump in the backcountry of Yellowstone Park. I live right there. I live just north of the park. But the whole state of Montana, we were so excited by this campaign, and so were a lot of people on the national scene. They saw it as a really emblematic turn where a state like Montana could ratchet up a campaign and get a guy like Rob Quist in there over another billionaire congressman that doesn't believe in climate change.
Okay, Doug Peacock, once again, unhappy Democrat in Montana. I want to go back to Evan Halper, our reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. We've heard from two people, Amanda Littman and Doug Peacock, who for different reasons are sort of declaring independence from the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Congressional Committee as well. I think Doug Peacock has indicated, to not on this program as yet, but elsewhere, that he hardly knew the difference between the two. Are they typical, do you think, of people around the country? Is there a new determination among Democrats?
I think it's a fair point. I mean, I think if we look at the results in Montana, if we look at the results in South Carolina, and also if we look at the results in Kansas before that in a special election where Democrats are just doing much better than they were expected to in these districts that the power, the party leadership structure had been writing off. There's a question about whether there needs to be some reallocation of resources. Now, you also need to be aware of the point that that Josh made earlier, which is that as soon as the National Party gets involved, it energizes the Republican base to come out and vote. And so it's a tricky balancing act to actually start engaging in these races where Democrats never had before. You could actually wind up hurting the Democratic candidate on the ballot.
Let me go back to Amanda Littman with Run for Something. Do you find that to be the case? So when you get these people energized, young people, 1,000 as opposed to 100 who actually want to, that you thought you'd get, who want to run for office, does that then, because they are Democrats, bring out Republicans to run against them?
We haven't seen that on the local level, in part because a lot of these races are a lot less partisan. When you're running against your neighbor or somebody you see at the grocery store every day, it's harder for the partisan labels to get in the mix of things. So it's something we're not as concerned about.
Doug Peacock, what do you say? And are there other races coming up in Montana that you want to focus on? And would Run for Something, for example, look good to you bringing in these young people who are running now for offices that may not be partisan at all, but may be able to move on then?
Yes. I can't speak for Rob Quist, but we have an election coming up again for that same seat. And if he chooses to run, I will be happy to support him the best I can. We think that the young people in the state of Montana are an almost untapped source. And we did that in electing John Tester some years back by going into the University of Montana. I gave a lecture to about 400 or 500 young people a couple of days before the election, and they went out to just register their friends. And the argument then was that the race was so close that the tester needed these 500 young people plus their friends.
He was running for the U.S. Senate?
Yes, and he made it. And he's coming up again. And actually, Gia Forte hadn't won the seat in the Congress, we think he probably would have run for the Senate office of John Tester because he ran against the governor, of course, a couple of years ago and got trounced. But that's it's a state that's realigning itself. And I sense a resistance in this country. And I'm talking about my mountain country here in western Montana. But it's really exciting. I haven't seen a spirit like this in a long time. It's really good.
So, Amanda Littman, you're looking at the nation as a whole, but you're taking a very different approach from Bernie Sanders, for example, who's still an independent rather than a Democrat, who doesn't caucus with the Democrats, but you're looking for people who ultimately will.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We think it's important to focus on building a long-term Democratic bench.
So, Evan Halper, what about this long-term issue? And given the way the Democratic strategy backfired in Atlanta, how are they going to back away from Nancy Pelosi and from the way that the Republicans are able traditionally to challenge them on and make them look too liberal?
It's a big problem, and it's something that's being talked about in Washington a lot today because Nancy Pelosi became a big issue in that election, as you mentioned. But one way is actually have stronger candidates. As we were talking about earlier, John Ossoff's resume was pretty thin. It was yet here comes $30 million into this race for this 30-year-old person that no one in the district had even really heard of before a few months ago. And it was easy for the Republicans to sort of project upon him just that he was this creation of the Democratic Party and he was this creation of Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, if you have a stronger candidate with a deeper resume and closer ties to the community, you know, it's harder to just project that onto the candidate. And so, you know, they do have several races coming up that where the registration is preferable for Democrats. The Republicans currently hold the district, but the outlook in terms of being able to win looks better than the Georgia 6 did, and they also have stronger candidates in them. So that may be able to help shed the baggage of Pelosi and the Democrats in Washington.
Okay, the Democrats, the party out of power in Washington at the moment and in 30 states around the country. Of course, the Republicans have problems of their own, as we'll learn tomorrow when they release their health care plan, when the Senate does. Anyway, and we'll see how that flies. In the meantime, thanks to you all for being with our program today. Evan Halper again with the Los Angeles Times in Washington. Amanda Littman, a co-founder of Run for Something, formerly with the Clinton campaign. Doug Peacock in Montana, where he's a wilderness advocate and a Democrat trying to make good with the young people or find out how to use the young people in that state. And our early guest, John Krosshauer, with the National Journal, and Cameron McWhirter with the Wall Street Journal in Atlanta. Thank you all very much for being on our show. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional, but what if it's partisan? We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point from PRI. Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to legislative gerrymandering in Wisconsin. The argument is that district boundaries have been drawn by Republicans to give them more seats than they deserve. It's a case that could change common practice going back almost to the beginning of political parties. Eric McGee is a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, define gerrymandering. What is it?
Partisan gerrymandering is the practice of, as you said, drawing district lines to try and produce more seats than you would otherwise hold for your party specifically.
And that means, otherwise, in what sense? I mean, by comparison to the registration or what polls show, or how do you know that it's wrong?
Well, that of course is one of the key questions that the Supreme Court is going to be addressing in this particular case. One of the things that they have complained about going back 30 years of jurisprudence on this question now is, how do we know when it's too much, right? When does it slide over from just a party has more seats to a party has actually produced a partisan gerrymander? And the case that is coming before the court has a particular answer to that question, but that's going to be a point of contention because it is a fact that these plans can, you know, you can have more seats as a party than you actually have in terms of vote share, And the question is, how much is too much?
And, of course, the redistricting is based on the census that is required by the Constitution every 10 years. So it has an effect when the legislative boundaries or the congressional district boundaries are drawn. They last for a long time.
Yeah, well, they last for the next 10 years. And every, as you said, every after every census, you have to draw new districts to make the to make them equal in population because people move around over time. And that's an opportunity for whoever is in control of the process to potentially draw districts that give themselves an extra advantage. And the way that this is done is if you when you have a single member district system, as they call it, which is what we have, any vote that is cast for a losing candidate is in a sense wasted because it doesn't go toward a win. Also, any vote cast in excess of the votes needed to win is also sort of wasted because, again, it's not going directly toward a win. And there's always a certain number of wasted votes in that sense in any single member district election. But the question is whether one party has more of those wasted votes than another. When it does, it tends to win more seats.
And, of course, in these times, this has become a very precise kind of exercise where the district boundaries can differ. There's one district running down one side of the street, and across the street it's another district, and it's very carefully drawn in order to make it come out the way that the legislature wants it to come out. How long has this been going? When did this start? And who was Gary? I think it was Gary rather than Jerry who gave his name to this.
Yes, it was Elbridge Gary. It goes back to, I believe, 1811 was that particular plan. The notion of drawing districts for partisan advantage even predates that, but that was the original. He was the governor of Massachusetts, and he signed the redistricting plan that created a district that many people thought looked like a salamander. And so they said, it's not a salamander, it's a gerrymander, or now what we say gerrymander. And so the history of this goes way back, but as you note, it has become more precise in recent years as computers have been brought to bear on the problem and the amount of data that's available it has increased. It is also, I think, more durable because people are more partisan than they used to be. The voters are more lined up with one party or the other. 30, 40 years ago, you redrew districts. It wasn't necessarily clear who these people were going to vote for because there were a lot of people who would identify as Democrats but vote Republican and vice versa. Now that's not so much the case. It's easier to tell what these plans are going to do, and the durability of them is therefore more certain.
Okay, so what about the case that the Supreme Court has now agreed to hear? It has ruled on partisan gerrymandering or gerrymandering that turns out to be racially oriented, and it's declared that unconstitutional. What's unconstitutional about the partisan gerrymandering?
Well, there's a variety of different theories out there, and this is one of the things that the court is going to hash out. But there's a general claim that when you have a partisan gerrymander, you are burdening the voters of the losing party more than the ones of the winning party, and so there's a variety of different angles through the Constitution to stake a claim, a constitutional claim there. But that's the basic idea, is that there's a sort of differential treatment. Some people think this becomes a sort of First Amendment thing. Some people say it's really more of a 14th Amendment thing. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really adjudicate all of that. But there are a number of different sort of theories, and that is precisely what is going to be at issue with the court, is exactly what theory do we want to endorse, if any theory.
So they could argue it on free speech grounds or on equal protection grounds, as you indicate. I'm not a lawyer either, we can go into it that far. Well, how likely is it that this court will, in fact, it took the case, but what do we know about the court that would suggest that it might come out one way or another?
Well, so the redistricting area of the law is a little bit unusual in the sense that normally you would have a lower court, the district court decision, as we had in Wisconsin, and then it would go to an appeals court, and then from the appeals court it might be appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could decide whether they wanted whether to sort of affirm the lower decision or overturn it, or they could decide to just let it sit for a while and percolate and not do anything at all and allow other cases to kind of work their way up so that there was sort of a number of perspectives that they could adjudicate between. In the case of redistricting, it skips the appellate court level entirely because there's a desire to have these things resolved as quickly as possible. And so when it came to the court basically had two options. They could hear the case and figure out whether they liked it or not, figured out whether they liked the ruling or not, or they could actually affirm the lower court's decision and say, that sounds like a good idea to me.
And the lower court said that it was unconstitutional in Wisconsin?
Yes, the lower court struck down the plan. Yes, that's right. So the I think the reason the court took it is because the court wants to actually, you know, carefully look at this question. They don't want to just sort of let the district court become the law of the land. And in terms of how it turns out, your guess is as good as mine. The key vote, everybody seems to agree, is Justice Kennedy. He has in the past expressed an openness to the idea of making partisan gerrymandering unconstitutional. What he has been concerned about is the ability to create a standard and, again, a threshold for deciding how much is too much, because there is the court generally believes that it's okay for some amount of partisan shenanigans to be going on.
Okay.
They just want to know at what point are those partisan shenanigans so bad that a voter's or party's constitutional rights have been violated, we're kind of in this. It's almost like this law has been, this area of the law has been in a bit of a coma. It was 30 years ago.
I'm going to have to introduce you in the interest of time, and I apologize for that. But once again, this is a case that could make an enormous amount of difference in states all over the country, not just Wisconsin. So it's going to be looked at very closely. Eric McGee with the Public Policy Institute of California. It's great to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.